Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast, the post-veto session edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is...
Jason Rosenbaum of the St. Louis Beacon.
And...
Joe Manis with the St. Louis Beacon.
And our special guest today to enlighten us about last week's event is...
Tom Dempsey, President of the Missouri Senate.
Very good to have you. First off, before we dive into veto session, why don't you tell us a little bit about your St. Charles district and who you are?
Okay. I represent the 23rd District in St. Charles County. I guess tell you a little bit about myself. I was born and raised in St. Charles, and my wife and I met at Rockhurst University up in Kansas City.
Okay.
And we're married, and then about a year after we were married, moved to St. Charles and to work for the family business, which is the restaurant business.
Is it a particular restaurant, or is it several restaurants?
It's Pio's Restaurant. I'm Italian on my mother's side.
Whoa.
My grandfather's first name was Pio, so that's where the name came from. And my father married my mother in the 60s and started with the restaurant in the late 60s, became a partner in 1970, and that's how Dempsey gets into the Italian food business.
I had the pleasure of interviewing you at your restaurant in December. It's a very nice establishment.
Thank you.
Just so I can suck up to you before we get into the hard questions.
Well, don't count your calories when you go there. When you've been in business as long as we have, you must be doing something right. And we've been very fortunate. The community's been very good to us. And I think that's the biggest connection that I have that the family has to the community is through the restaurant. And moved back home. Actually, we have a banquet center. A partnership in that, and I ran that for a number of years prior to getting on the city council. And meanwhile, we had, through a period of years, three children. And I have two in college now, a junior and a freshman at Mizzou. The junior is studying abroad and an eighth grader. And so I guess that's just a thumbnail about myself.
Now, you mentioned you work for a bank, too?
Yeah, I work for First National Bank of St. Louis. I'm coming up on 6 years.
What do you do there?
Business development, primarily commercial lending. But it's a very good bank and Missouri chartered. And make their decisions here locally, and I'm trying to help grow their market in the region.
I believe your colleague from St. Charles, Scott Roop, also works at a bank, so there's some commonality between the two esteemed senators from St. Charles in that regard.
And Chuck Gross had prior to that also.
Yes, following in that tradition as well.
Well,
but you know, how did you decide to get involved in politics?
Right.
What prompted you to run for the city council and the state representative and also the state senate?
Well, my interest in government started really in high school, and was going to DeSmet, and had government teacher Bob Christian, who I heard was a big Democrat, so maybe he's disappointed in what he helped create. But anyway, I enjoyed those classes: American government, social studies, learning about the founding of our country. At that time, Ronald Reagan was running for president, and I like being a part of things that are very special, and I think my community, my family, the country that I live in are all special, and Ronald Reagan really kind of hit home, and I identified with the things that he talked about, because he talked about how great we were as a country. And so that happened in high school, and then I was running the banquet center and had a local community leader come up to me and say, hey, have you ever given any thought to running for city council? I think you do a good job. We're looking for candidates. And I thought, well, here's this opportunity, this interest that I had years ago in high school. I can see what public service is all about.
Right.
Yeah. And, 2.5 years later, Chuck Gross ran for the state senate. The state rep job would have been an open seat. I think, enjoyed city politics, streets, creeks, sewers, those types of issues, neighborhood issues. But the ones at the state level, those are more of the ones that we're talking about at the dining room table: education, health care, crime, tax policy, and had a supportive ownership, supportive family, and so ran, and here I am today.
Now, you are the top Republican senator in the Missouri Senate.
I think
the
top of senator.
Top senator.
The top senator.
Step back.
But I was just going to ask you.
I refer to myself as really first among equals.
Yeah. But that's what that was going to be my question. I just wanted to kind of ask you to touch on your role as president pro tem and to also just maybe expound on the fact that even though you are president of the pro tem, the Senate works differently from the House, where individual members have more power and more say than, say, the House, because you've been in both chambers. Could you just kind of talk a little bit about what your role is and, you know, how it kind of runs this, or not necessarily runs the Senate, but how it kind of goes in with the operations of the Senate?
Sure. I guess formally, you know, I have the ability to preside, rule on points of order, preside when the lieutenant governor is not there. And you get into the other nuts and bolts, naming of committee chairman, committee membership. You know, those are some of the aspects of the job. Bill referral. Now, in the Senate, the House has a lot more flexibility, though all bills have to be sent to committee by the end of the year. The Senate, the bills have to be taken in order and sent to committee. So if I want to get to Bill 500, I've got to refer the other 499. So bill referral is a part of that. And then after bills are voted out of committee, then I would have some discretion over taking those bills in and then putting them on the calendar. And after they get to the calendar, then that becomes the majority leader's job. So that's kind of the formal parts of the job. But really just I've focused on trying to create an environment where we can solve the problems that face the state and getting people to work together, because it is more collaborative on the Senate side if you're going to move forward. And, you know, we wanted to move. We had a very ambitious schedule in 2013 with what we wanted to accomplish in improving Missouri's business climate. And instead of having within my own caucus 24 people, each one saying, over my dead body, will we do X? You know, let's, you know, be passionate about your issues. Fight for what you believe in. Compromise where you can. At the end of the day, there have been a number of things that we've just been unable to deal with because we can't get them to a vote. And in those areas where you can't agree, there is broad consensus, but what I'm asking, instead of filibustering it, if we could get some of these issues to a vote and take care of some of these things we haven't been able to take care of. And to a great extent, we were able to deal with some subjects that we hadn't been able to. And in some other areas, you know, I was a little frustrated that there were a couple things we couldn't get done.
Which brings us to the veto session.
Last week's veto
and session. For the listeners, I mean, veto session is where the legislature gets back into session and they just try to override all of the vetoes that the governor did. In this case, there was 29 vetoes up, and in the Senate, you need 23 votes. And there were a number of vetoes overridden, a record number in modern times, but a couple of the big ones did not. Do you want to talk just a little bit about what you – did the veto session proceed as you thought it would? Was there any particular surprises for you on the Senate side? Because I know in a lot of ways the Senate was waiting, just waiting to see what the House was doing.
I would say generally it worked out as I thought it would. There were a couple of surprises. You know, I thought that the tax cut, that we passed the first tax cut in 100 years. But you know, I knew when we had in theory, veto-proof majorities after Election Day with some of our supporters, that would be this kind of Katie bar the door mentality that we have all this backlog of things that we can't get through a Democrat governor. Now we don't have to worry about a Democrat governor. Well, we still don't have unanimity of thought,
yeah.
You know, just as you disagree with probably some of your own family members. But I think talking about a tax cut is talking about shortcomings with it. The loss is going to lead to, you know, a better bill next year. And so that was one thing we weren't able to accomplish, but I thought the chances were slim that we were going to get that done.
Was it because of the sales tax stuff that was in there?
Well, you know, we actually, and I think it was demonstrated, someone found that the communication between the sponsor of the bill and the governor's office, they were consulted on the bill. So, you know, I saw a comment from the governor talking about our work being sloppy. Well, We even had cases mm-hmm. where we worked with the executive branch and we didn't get the language right. But, yeah, some of that I thought the prescription drug aspect of it, we would have filed a bill first day of pre-filing. We would have ran it early. We could have had it on the governor's desk with an emergency clause by Valentine's Day. And that provision would not have taken place until 2015 anyway. So I thought that was a red herring. Some of his other criticism of the bill, the part related to the Main Street Fairness Act and exaggerating the size of the hole in the budget, not talking about the triggering mechanisms that we had in the bill. But other people did listen. So we're going to go back and we're going to take care of some of those issues. That's probably what Senator Krause and Senator Schmidt and others are working on right now, is what does next year's bill look like. So, you know, that was kind of the biggest bill out there, the one that had grabbed the most attention. The bill related to the Second Amendment was another one that people were and I know we'll get to that.
Right.
getting a lot of attention. But, you know, I think there were 10 bills overridden.
Which one do you think was the most consequential? Because sort of the two big marquee ones weren't overridden.
Right.
But there were some that will have consequences, will be consequential. Which one do you look at and say, this is the most important override that we were able to do?
Well, I think that first I want to point out the 10 overrides, I think, to some degree is a consequence of the governor's office or staff not communicating during the legislative process.
Do you think there needs to be more communication or
– It would help.
Okay.
It would help. To not find out what they're thinking until after July 14th.
Okay.
I'm not the only one who's had that complaint. The two biggest bills are the two that I think of are the bill related to I guess it's a smaller tort reform issue, and Doe Run is the company most often connected to that. That was a big accomplishment for the legislature, and as was the no pay, no play bill. Mentioned to Jason prior to getting on the air, the insurance industry had been pursuing that for over 20 years. You know, here we have this requirement that everyone should have insurance if they, you know, have a vehicle or driving on our roads, and yet people continue to not do that.
So that bill, well, now that it's law, means that if you're uninsured and you're in an accident, you can't get punitive damages
Right, you can't get non-economic damages.
Right.
And there's a couple of exceptions that were made. If someone, the person that you were in an accident with was on drugs or intoxicated, then you would be able to receive non-economic damages.
Were you surprised with the Doe Run bill? The one thing that I thought was really interesting was it wasn't your normal coalition that would override a bill. It wasn't necessarily conservative Democrats or Democrats that constantly vote with Republicans. It was somewhat progressive Democrats, labor-friendly Democrats.
Yeah, labor was really big on this bill.
Why do you think that coalition came together to override that bill?
Well, because we're talking about good-paying jobs in an area where there just aren't that many other options. And there will be damages that will be paid out. And that's where you get to, as we talk about tort reform, and it's going to be an issue probably for next year, is that balance that needs to be there. That, yes, when people are wrong, there needs to be, you know, there needs to be a response for that. Those people need to be taken care of and not forgotten. But we can't have a legal climate that is so punitive that it drives people out of the state of Missouri. But in this case, because it's related to a lead mine, they won't be leaving Missouri, they'll just be closing operations. And I think they're the last working lead mine in the country. And at a time where, you know, people are going, we're having discussions about can we run automobiles on electric, and, you know, we still use lead to make those batteries. And so they provide good paying jobs, and they're in an industry sector where there's demand.
So now we'll get to the
elephant in the room.
Okay. HB 4, 436, which was the called the Second Amendment bill or the gun nullification major. Had
Second Amendment Preservation Act,
yes.
I believe.
And which basically would have restricted enforcement of federal gun laws in Missouri and other things. Obviously, in many ways, you ended up being the key player in that, in what happened with that bill. Do you want to talk about that a bit? I mean, sort of what your decision-making was and kind of the atmosphere about it. I was over in the House when it passed the House by the exact number, and actually it seemed like some of the House members, the feeling on the floor, you had a sense that some were actually shocked that it passed. I mean, it's just one. It was an odd situation. So anyway, I was interested in your take about what happened in the Senate, why you decided to take the position you did, and what happens.
Well, I had been giving the bill a lot of thought. I talked to you just prior to session, was trying to come to a conclusion on what I might do when the bill came to the floor. My record on, gun ownership and the Second Amendment goes back, I've number of votes over 13 years, going back to the override of my support for concealed carry and the override. And so I've supported gun ownership, allowing law-abiding citizens to carry concealed firearms, supporting hunting and fishing rights, and things along the line. This bill, I guess one of the criticisms I had from a few people was, why did you vote for it during session? And then against
although I noticed that Gina Walsh and Paul Lavoda voted for it too, strangely, and I don't know why they did that either. But that's an aside. You weren't the only person that changed your vote on that. So continue.
Well, it's something that I think a lot about, I think at the time I made the decision I did during session with the information that was available to me at the time.
So was there particular outside pieces of some, information?
Well,
that
outside
you found
of some
out
criticism from
mind?
The Press Association, they're really. The governor hadn't weighed in. The attorney general hadn't said anything. Law enforcement hadn't really chimed in on the bill, I heard somebody refer to it as a knee-jerk reaction to a knee-jerk reaction. But you do have posturing or discussions at the federal level to further restrict gun ownership and. Against what many people believe, myself included, is very clear language in the Second Amendment that says that the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. So as we got to veto session, you had those groups that had not participated during the legislative process, had not come to committee hearings, had weighed in on the bill. The NRA was neutral on the bill.
Did they call you? Did anybody call you from the NRA and say, look, we're not taking a stance?
No, okay. No. I knew that they had not taken a position on the bill. Mm-hmm. The attorney general, our top prosecutor for the state of Missouri, had given his opinion on the bill. The attorney general, the former attorney general, now the governor, mm-hmm. had given his opinion on the bill. And law enforcement groups had weighed in. The Press Association or members of different newspapers across the state talked about their objections and looked again at the language and thought that, I gave the benefit of the doubt during session on the legislation, but to go to the threshold of overriding the governor, I needed the level of certainty needed to be there. And frankly, at the end of the day, I was concerned about the unintended consequences of the bill. And my belief that there may be circumstances occur upon a successful override that would embarrass the legislature or embarrass the majority party that is governing that legislature. And the response I would hear would be, well, we can, many people who were a part of the bill or had been involved in agreed that there were problems with the bill and just wanted to fix those next year. I had others tell me that, don't worry about it. The Press Association is going to file suit next year. And so I really don't like that response either. That's really an admission that we could have done a better job of drafting the language and that if I'm going to count on a lawsuit to stop it, then that's not the right answer either. And we just need to do a better job of drafting the bill. And we can do that. We can take care of it early next year. And, you know, we can still have this fight with the federal government over what the 10th Amendment means. But we can just do it the right way. The other thing I thought about, like, kind of in the hour prior to the vote was I was going to come before the press as I do,
right,
on a weekly basis, and I was going to have to explain what had happened, why we'd overridden the bill or why the bill had failed. And I felt much comfortable with the latter position. I couldn't, with all sincerity, with the problems that were in the bill and the potential harm I thought it could do, be sincere in my defense of the override. And so I decided I'm going to vote no, and we'll start working on next year's bill after veto session.
Now, I talked to Nieves, state senator, who was the big defender of the bill in the Senate. I talked to him a couple days ago, and he basically was saying that he was taking some of the concerns to heart, and that he recognized that he said he was going to be pushing for a revised version, but that he wasn't going to be pushing for the same version. Which I thought was interesting. So do you think that can be – are there any provisions of that bill that you think are going to have to be fought again? Are there some provisions that are automatically going to be tossed out, like the thing about identifying gun owners or the thing about the provision that law enforcement said would prevent them from being involved in federal task forces, that sort of thing?
Well, that's what we need to spend some time on. You know, there are additional things coming to light, like if you have a complete rejection of the federal laws on gun ownership and gun regulation, well, the feds ban illegal aliens from possessing firearms.
Right.
We don't have a state law that does that.
Right.
You know, so we just need a complete review, and kind of what you're getting to is, do we need a complete rework of the bill, or can we address certain things by amendment or better language? And I'm not there yet as to say exactly what that bill looks like.
Now, what was the fallout of your vote? Did you get threats? Did you have people call you upset about it? Or did people get what the issue was?
We had a lot of emails to the office, other through social media, Twitter or Facebook. Got comments from some supportive. I've got supportive comments from some legislators as well. Both in the House and Senate, and also certainly a number of people who were upset with my vote, and so yes, I did get quite a bit of feedback, and I put my statement together on the reasons for my position, the concerns that I had with the legislation. I put it up on Facebook. I sent it out to everyone who sent me an email. We sent a response, and I think once people have had an opportunity to read, to get more background, to understand some of the shortcomings of the bill and some of the drafting errors and the potential harm that they would do, kind of the subsequent response I would get was a lot more understanding about why I voted the way I voted.
Now, in I guess the week of or the week before the veto session, House Majority Leader Ron Richards came out publicly. Ron Richard, not Ron Richards. I get that mistaken all the time.
Yeah.
He came out against the bill, and I thought that was a significant development because he holds a lot of gravitas. He has a lot of allies in the legislature. When someone like that comes out against the bill, it usually means other people are going to come out against it too. I wasn't expecting you to be the other person. I was expecting to be someone like Jay Wasson, who he's very close with, or others. Were there other people that wanted to vote no on this bill but just felt they couldn't for some reason? That's why you had to do it? Or were you going to vote no regardless of what happened?
Well, I came to my conclusion just resolving the issue with myself. You know, what it felt in my head and my heart. I know that I wasn't the only legislator in either chamber that was concerned about the impact of the bill and some of the negative consequences. But I can't tell you what was in their mind. We didn't ask everybody what their vote was going to be when we caucused on it, but we did just kind of talk over about the bill, and And so I guess I'm really – I can't tell you why or what was in the minds of other senators and House members.
So did some know that you were going to vote against – the reason I'm asking is this. The roll call of the Senate on that bill I thought was interesting because there was a couple senators. One of them was Senator Schmidt, who when people vote, they go by district. And when it got to their districts,
well,
they...
It's alphabetical.
It's alphabetical.
Or whatever, but they...
Because I always wish I could be like a Wolford or...
or a Wallingford.
Yeah,
or a,
yeah, a Wallingford or a
Walsh. My point being that the first time they either passed or present or did something like that, so then the woman taking the vote then went back to them.
Yeah, if, at least two if they're absent... Yes,
yeah, you, and, can, and may, yeah.
You can pause and then they'll skip over you and they'll come
so
back.
So my question was, were these other senators, because there was traffic about on Twitter about that. There was assertions by some conservatives that the two senators who were either not in the room or whatever and that had voted at the very end, that they had been poised to vote against it if need be or whatever. I'm not... asserting that, I'm just saying Twitter went crazy within minutes from certain conservatives who were saying that. So I was just – what's your take on what happened?
Listen, I didn't – there wasn't any discussion in our caucus okay. meeting about I'm going to do this so you do that.
Okay.
You know, it was – members knew when we left our meeting that I was voting no.
Okay.
Okay. That's – I will tell you, that's what they did know.
Okay.
And I think they also knew that Senator Richard was going to be voting no. Beyond that, there was no other discussion.
Right. And for the listeners to understand that
about who was voting
right.
how.
You needed two Republicans to vote no and all the Democrats to vote no for the override not to happen.
Right.
Right. So exactly. That's
just yeah, we needed 23.
Right, correct.
We've talked a little bit about what we can expect next session, a retooling of 253, the income tax cut bill, and a reworking of this law. What other bills can we expect coming up next session?
Okay, well, prior to January, we had spent a lot of time in policy development, first as with members who were returning and then kind of later in the year with who we thought was likely going to be serving in the chamber. And that's where we came up with the focus on business climate and look on infrastructure, education, and economic development, and then the different specific bills that came under that. This year, we have members who have a year of experience now or 3 years of experience, with the amount of overrides, the considerations that needed to be taken into account, we haven't done a lot on policy development. And my communications with the press and other circumstances have been and will continue to be that the Senate Republicans are going to caucus and have a retreat in November where we're going to sit down and develop our priorities for next year. And, you know, what I can give you is kind of based on my read thus far or what I think some of the things are outside of the tax cut bill and the Second Amendment bill. And so some of the things that you've been reporting on, I think, are likely to come up next year, related to education policy. You know, this process of dealing with school transfers. You know, 1993, then Democrats passed the Outstanding Schools Act for 9 years that they were in control. They never developed a process. DESE never developed a process. The 10 years that or so that we've been in control, we didn't develop a process that we discussed it and. 2012, and you know, with the Supreme Court's decision that was handed down in June, and what has ensued since then, I think we're going to spend a lot of time dealing with that issue and now, trying to develop. And as a part of that, we're going to have to look at. So the Outstanding Schools Act basically said we're going to increase your education funding, but there are going to be expectations that go along with that. Okay, well. So what do we do when we have a school district that's not performing? You know, we over 10 years, between 93 and 2002, we increased education funding 120%. We've increased it since then, not at that rate. But back to the question of what do you do when you have a failing school district? And So we're going to spend our time solving that problem and making sure that, number one, that children have access to a quality education. I think second would be we believe that education, if at all possible, should take place in the community where they live. And then and how do we do that? You know, school funding continues to be out there as an issue. If you look at the last two school funding formulas, it was they were developed after a lawsuit. And so we don't seem to get much done in education policy unless there's a lawsuit that has to be, you know, and that's whether it's under Republican or Democrat control. But so that issue, higher education, we had a bill that passed late in the Senate on performance funding. Senator Pierce has done a lot of work on that, and that's likely to come up next year. Healthcare reform.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to ask you, the Medicaid.
Yeah, I've got a committee that Senator Romine is chairing, looking at what we can do to bend the cost curve in healthcare. To it's an issue that I spent some time on my first 2 years. We've got, you know, all members that are I would say 3 years or less in their legislative terms, so there's going to be some continuity going into next year and next term. And so we'll have their report in December. I know that between now and then, you'll also have the exchanges are supposed to move forward on October 1st. Other aspects of the Affordable Health Care Act, I think, are to take effect after January 1. So all those things are going to kind of play into what healthcare policy is going to look like, next year. And so expansion of Medicaid, that discussion will probably occur.
Well, I wanted to ask you this because I asked Senator Roop this. Do you think that that issue of Medicaid expansion, whether it's straight expansion or a quote-unquote reform plan, is going to get intertwined in the certificate of need issue that Senator Schaaf has brought up for years and years and years? I mean, you had personal experience when you put forward a smaller Medicaid expansion, and it got intertwined with that. Do you think that's going to happen again this time?
Well, I know that certificate of need is, for Senator Schaaf, a key component of health care reform. That if you really want to talk about health care reform and bringing competition and price down, that elimination of certificate of need.
And that involves the licensing.
Yeah, it's basically a requirement that you've got to get state approval before you can make a sizable health investment in the healthcare facility or healthcare equipment.
Yes.
So the state, through this committee, determines if you're able to open a hospital, if you're able to buy a piece of equipment that's I think over $1 million.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm not sure. And so we may have a debate on that issue, and so it may be part of it. I told the chairman of the committee and committee members, listen, I don't have a preordained direction. I'm asking you to go and listen, and you're all very capable, very intelligent people. Sit down and try to put something forward which that gives us a little bit of direction going into January when we actually draft a bill and try to move something.
Yeah, because one of the things that came up, I covered a town hall a couple days ago on the Obamacare, but one of the points that was emphasized is that, okay, with the exchanges, people who buy insurance through the exchanges, if they make up to a certain level, if for family four, it's about $94,000, they can get they will be getting a tax break. Or a subsidy to help make it more affordable. But there's a minimum income for that too because of the assumption under the federal law that the people who make below that will be able to get on Medicaid. Well, because in Missouri, that's not the case. You've got several hundred thousand people who won't be on Medicaid but also won't be able to qualify for any subsidies. I mean, do you see the state addressing that at all, whether you expand Medicaid or not, or if you do something else? Well, I'm just interested if that aspect is even on the radar.
Well, that's where there are so many different beliefs on what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason why I got involved in healthcare was because there are problems with access to care, quality of care, cost of care. Okay, and what I would have preferred was state flexibility, much like they did in welfare reform in 94. Give block granted out, let us develop our own solutions. We can learn one from one another. Somebody can do a completely socialistic single-payer system. Somebody can do a completely free market, and we can do 48 things in between. But that's not what we have. And so, as Republican majorities in the state Senate still believe that this is going to be a train wreck, you know, and that's what time will dictate who's right. Is it a train wreck? Is it all the promise that the president has he envisioned, or is it something in between?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's going to dictate what's happening at the national level. You know, do companies continue to move people to more part-time employment for cost avoidance? Do they dump people that were that they provided insurance for? Now do they dump them into the exchange? Do young healthy people buy insurance, or do they just pay the penalty? You know, all those questions have yet to be answered. You know, does the federal government, they're going to pull away DSH payments over a 7-year period. Does that affect their viability as a going concern? And some of the either city in St. Louis City and places like Christian North or down in Pemiscot. And so, you know, I'm paying attention to it, and I know others as well. And that's kind of really I think what's going to as that plays out, it's going to affect our policy.
Do you hear much in your district about that? And I also wanted to ask, also, do you hear much in the district about the whole transfer situation, since your district is affected by that, the whole Normandy?
Yeah, I've got the Francis Howell School District. It's not as much, you know, and I think certainly the students that are at the Francis Howell School District are there to learn and get a better education. I think that's why their parents sent them there. They had that choice. And but we do have the DESE asking for, what, $6.8 million for the Normandy School District. I think, you know, ideally that's what we want, the kids to get a quality education in their neighborhoods or in their community. And so we need a solution that takes that into account.
Before we get into the last question, is there any other things about the session next that you want to mention?
So the performance funding healthcare, a state infrastructure, just had toured the state hospital in Fulton, and the place is slowly turning into rubble, and it's the only state hospital that we have. We need to address it, and that may be a part of some discussion, whether through general revenue or a bonding legislation. How we address that, and then there are other needs in state infrastructure, some related to tourism or in our state parks, some in the area of academic achievement and economic development. And so that's other legislation that I'd like to see to get debated on the Senate floor.
Is there going to be another attempt, I mean, at a capital improvements type thing, which everyone thought was agreed on back in May?
It was never a priority for us last year.
Okay.
You know, and when you were talking about potentially going to the ballot in 2014 with the bond issue, well, it never needed to be taken care of necessarily last year. So we passed a bill out of committee early, and that's where it sat. And so this year was really the time for discussion. I also put another committee together to look at some of those needs across the state, because I just didn't want a situation where, okay, there's a bonding bill. It's going to have priorities across the state. I got to make sure I get something for my district. You know, it needs to be needs based and not just be on the list because there's a list. It's we owe it to the taxpayers to make sure that where we can leverage private dollars, we do that. That there's truly a need and a benefit to the state of Missouri and in each project that would be a part of this infrastructure proposal.
Joe, I believe you had one more question
about future plans. Yes. What are your future plans? You're term limited, so you're out in
2016.
2016, correct?
That's right.
What are your thoughts about what you may or may not do after that?
Well, I enjoy public service. I'm very fortunate to represent the 23rd District and my community. I have not made any decisions. I thought, first, I need to do a good job. Mm-hmm. I need, as a senator for my district, as the president of the Senate, and I thought, for 2 years, that's all I'm going to focus on, and the policies that I think we need to face and to the problems that we need to solve as a state. And if that makes me less electable, then that's not shouldn't be a consideration. And so I've got another year, and you know, I'm just going to keep my head down and keep doing my job and leave that decision for another day.
Are you thinking of not doing another term as pro tem after 2015?
I serve at the pleasure, I guess, of the Senate and Senate Republicans. So mm-hmm. I've never taken anything for granted. I don't, you know, and any election that I ever had, I call it a nervous paranoia. You know, you wake up every morning and think, what do I need to do today? And you just focus on your job and do the best you can.
Yeah, because I've heard a lot from Republicans and Democrats, current and past senators, who have a high regard for you. So at least
I hope they don't do anything to screw that up over the next 3 years. You know, the restaurant industry, I say you're only as good as your last meal. Okay.
Well, we're gonna end it at that. We're gonna go have some lunch here at the senator's restaurant.
Yeah, what's the name of it? It's
called Pio's Restaurant. And I guess based on some of the social media I've been reading, I have to trumpet our Provel based pizza. It's quite astounding, and we are winning over mozzarella lovers every day.
You're making this person that doesn't eat dairy very sad.
I do eat dairy, so I'm intrigued.
All right. Well, we'll end it on that note. You can read all of my stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can read all of Joe and Jason's stories at stlbeacon.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. You can follow Jason on Twitter at
Jay Rosenbaum.
You can follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JMANNIES.
And you can follow the senator on Twitter at
Senator Dempsey.
Thank you very much for coming in. We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.